what do you do when life happens? Around here, we just get catalytic. My name is Cheryl Hirsch-Kramer. I'm the host of your show. I am so glad you've chosen to be with us this evening. We know you've got lots of choices for your time, and you chose to be here either live or on the archive. So thank you very much for that. And I don't know how well you know me. If you're new to the show, if you've been here for the first two episodes, if you know me from my other work, but I'm going to ask you to do me a favor, please, one friend to another. I want you to listen very intently to what we're going to be talking about this evening. This may be one of the most important hours you've ever spent, because we're going to talk about how love created a whole different reality. If my guests didn't do what they did, I will tell you right now that Emily, my other guest, would not be here today. Her mother created her daughter's existence, her daughter's birth, her daughter's health. She was told many, many years ago this was not going to be a healthy child, and you're going to hear the story about that. Many times we hear scary diagnoses in life. Many times our friends hear scary diagnoses in life, or our relatives do. And I want you to know that we have choice. There are things that we can do. Fran and Emily are a beautiful example of what reality can be if we just choose to focus on what's possible in life and not take everything as fact, because nobody knows what's going to happen, but it's good to believe in love. My guests this evening are Francine Steeter, a very old and dear friend of mine. Well, actually, we're the same age, so if you're old, I'm old, right? I guess that's where it goes. But a longtime friend of mine I've known for over 30 years, and her beautiful daughter, Emily. And we're going to talk about their story. As you're listening to the show tonight, please share this with your friends. This will be archived in about 24 hours after the original air date, and you can listen to it on iTunes. You can listen to it on BBS Radio Station 1, which is bbsradio.com/catalytic. Hope you're there. And I'm going to give you my website. I haven't done that yet. Really should be doing that. To learn more about the work that I offer, please go to transformingthroughlove.com. And you'll read about my miraculous story that I was able to have two extra years with my dog. So, okay. Fran and Emily, welcome to Catalytic. How are you both tonight?
Good. How you doing? We're very well. I'm good.
Now you're sounding good. We can do this together. I'm so happy about this. So, okay, we're going to go back in time to the late 1980s, which, if you're old enough to remember the late 1980s, what music were you listening then? We didn't have iPods then, but what were you listening to on the radio? What clothes were you wearing? Were you wearing those big shoulder dresses like I used to have and I gave to Fran after I was on? Do you remember that dress I gave to you, Fran, from Jeopardy with the ridiculous shoulder pads?
Yes. And I had the big hair.
It was ridiculous.
I wore leg warmers and things like that.
That's right. Big hair, leg warmers, big shoulders, big everything. So
right.
back in the late 1980s, you got pregnant with your second child, and you were happy about this. You were delighted to be giving birth to another child. And tell us about your pregnancy. What happened during your pregnancy?
It started off okay until about the 12th week. And I started having problems with cramping and bleeding. And I saw my doctor, and she put me on bed rest. And eventually, I was put into the hospital because I had a possible, what they called a placenta abruptio, which is when the placenta pulls away from the wall of the uterus. And if that does happen, if it completely detaches, it could cause the death of both myself and my baby. So while I was in the hospital, my doctor came to me and said, well, how long do you want to milk this pregnancy? Which was kind of an unprofessional thing to say. And I said, well, is it possible that I could have the baby? And she said, anything's possible. So I decided that I was going to lie there and do everything I could to have Emily. And in that period of time, 1989, a baby is born as early as Emily, which was 25 weeks. had only a 50-50 chance of survival. I believe that at the time, the hospital I was in, St. Peter's in New Brunswick, was the best place for her to be born because it had the best neonatal intensive care unit in the area. And it was very stressful, and I worried every minute of the day, and if I moved, I bled, and at 25 weeks, my husband Marty and my son David came to visit me, and David had had his birthday party earlier that day, so they brought me cake. When my nurse asked how I was feeling, I told her I was having a lot of cramps that day, and they put me on the fetal monitor. That's when they saw that Emily was in distress. Her heart rate was slowing. Every time I had a contraction, they had to do an emergency C-section immediately. I was given an epidural, which didn't work, so I felt everything throughout the delivery. I really didn't care about the pain, though. I just wanted them to save my baby. I found out later that Emily had had the cord wrapped around her neck 3 times, so it really was a miracle that she survived. Dr. Hyatt,
What I want to do before you continue, I want to go back. When you were pregnant with Emily, your son was, what, 2 or 3 years old at that time?
He was actually 5.
He was 5. Okay, I remember him being really young. And you were bleeding while you were taking care of him, right? So you had to keep taking breaks from taking care of him to go lie down and rest. Am I remembering this correctly?
Well, I probably had to stay in bed most of the time. I think I had my mom come over and help me with him because I needed to be on bed rest.
So how do you have a 5-year-old boy, an active 5-year-old boy, and follow the doctor's orders about doing bed rest? That's not an easy balance to hit.
No, and I think it really had an effect on him as well because he was a very sensitive child. He was always so aware of other people's feelings and what was going on even in the world, and he worried about everything. So I think it really did have an effect on him. And it was difficult for him. But we tried to keep it as normal as possible for him, although normal wasn't a thing at that time, you know.
You did your best with the situation that you had. Okay, so I wanted to put that down as a baseline because you had a guilt at the time that you couldn't be the mother he needed you to be because you needed to be on bed rest to make sure he had a healthy sister showing up.
Yes, that's true. So we tried to pay a lot of extra attention to him sometimes. You know, of course, Marty, my husband, was just the most wonderful father with him and always made sure that he had special times with him to make him feel that he wasn't really being set aside, you know, just because I was pregnant with a baby that wanted to come early. he made him feel very important, and that was really very special to me. Marty's got a big heart.
He does. He's a wonderful man, and God bless you've got a great family. So let's go back. You know, you've given birth to your daughter at 25 weeks, and how much did she weigh at birth?
Oh, she was 1 pound, 2.5 ounces.
Okay, so that's about 18.5 ounces. Did she fit in the palm of your hand, as I recall?
Oh, yes, but I didn't even get to hold her for 7 weeks, even though she would have fit in the palm of my hand. They bathed her in a... Excuse me?
Okay, so you weren't able to hold her. We'll get to that part of the story in a minute. So you went through this very difficult childbirth because the epidural didn't take, and she had the cord wrapped around her 3 times, and you're in labor, and you give birth to this baby. And what happens then?
Well, then we start worrying about how she's going to do and whether she's going to make it. I think that because we were not professional medical people, we probably had more hope and more positive feeling about her surviving than if we knew more. So I was glad, kind of, that we didn't. But we
ignorance
just,
can be bliss, can't it? It's really great.
When she was in the isolette, Marty and I would talk to her, we would sing to her, and we would always tell her how much we loved her and how strong she was. We always told her how strong she was and that she would be okay and that she just needed to be strong and everything would be fine. And I think that that gave her, you know, that positive feeling kind of helped her through a lot of things. When we would come and visit her, even though she was so tiny, she would open her eyes when she heard our voices, which I thought was amazing for a baby that little. And it was just such a special feeling to be there with her. And we even made a tape with our voices, and Marty read to her, and I sang to her. And even David got onto the tape and talked to her so that she would hear our voices and be familiar with us.
That's beautiful. How did you know to do this? Were you advised to do this by the hospital staff? Was it intuitive? Had you talked to other mothers of high-risk babies? How did you know to do all of this?
I think that the nurses were very helpful with it. They gave us advice on what to do, and I think that they may have suggested doing the tape recording. And it was great because when we couldn't be there, she could still hear our voices. And I know that Emily, even though she was born at 25 weeks, her lungs developed to 28 weeks. And the doctor, who was the head neonatologist, came to my room and told me that he heard a baby cry and was shocked to see that it was little Emily crying. He was impressed with her lung capacity. And to this day, if I need someone called, you know, if I want someone called out to because my voice isn't loud enough, I just ask Emily to yell. Her voice carries very well.
See, I told you this is great. You did have purpose. So let's put a few more details into the story. So you have the baby. She's mm-hmm. small.
Yes.
Being cared for in the isolette. How long was she in the hospital before you were allowed to bring her home?
She was in for 3.5 months, from April 9th to July 31st.
Wow.
And that was scary, taking her home. I was afraid to take
before
her home. I felt incompetent.
Before we get to take her home. Let's go back to when she was in the hospital, because I want people to get a feeling for what it was like to be in this situation. You've got a five-year-old at home. You're recovering from a difficult childbirth. How often were you able to get to the hospital to spend time with your daughter?
I was there every day, and Marty was there every day. I had wonderful neighbors who drove me there before I was allowed to drive, and I would go there when David was in school. And then Marty would wait until Dave and I fell asleep at night, and he would go. And he would be there at 10 or 11 p.m. So he was the night shift, and everyone knew him there. And I think that they stopped charging us for parking because mm-hmm. we were there every single day, which was very nice
Aww.
Of them.
But, that's beautiful. Okay. So you're going through this experience, and you're still recovering. Did you always know that she was going to be okay throughout the pregnancy and throughout her time in the hospital without you there physically with her all the time?
No, I didn't always know, but I kept my...
Oh, boy. Stop it.
I'm sorry. I kept positive. And as I said, because we didn't know as much as a professional would, I think we were more positive because of that, which kind of helped. I remember when I first went in to see her, I practically passed out. I was wheeled in a wheelchair, and I I guess the shock of what a premature baby that size looks like was really hard for me to handle. But the nurses and doctors there in the NICU are so amazing, and they show so much love to these babies that I think that their love partially gives the babies a better chance, in addition to the love of her family.
Now, I remember when you were going through this, and it's funny because a lot of things in my life I've forgotten thanks to a couple strokes, but I remember vividly going through this experience, witnessing what you were doing, and I was in awe of your courage. I was in awe of your faith that it was going to work out okay. Because as I recall, and please correct me if I'm wrong about this, not all the people who were taking care of you and Emily were optimistic about her chances for a healthy life.
Absolutely true. My brother-in-law at the time was a doctor, and he said, don't get too attached to her. And I didn't want to hear it. You know, I didn't want to hear the negativity. So I relied mostly on the people who were positive about everything. I reached out to family, to friends, and asked that they all pray for Emily. And they all sent such positive vibes, I could say, that I think it really made a difference for Emily.
I believe you're right. I mean, I saw this with my dog when she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, that your attitude will really create a whole different reality if you allow it to do so. And you actually stayed focused on what was right for her. I remember when you were either pregnant or when you first had Emily. And Emily, we're going to get to you in a minute, honey. Don't worry about it. We're going to bring you in because we want to hear about your experience when you were waiting to go home for those 3.5 months, how you had a visitor, somebody very special that all of us get to see. We're going to hear about that in just a minute. But am I correct in remembering that the doctors thought that she might have some physical incapacities or some mental incapacities?
They thought, well, they didn't really realize that there would be major problems until she was like 10 months old, and they thought maybe she had cerebral palsy and that she would never walk. And she was at that point in an early intervention program. And the therapists there worked so hard, and of course we worked so hard with her, and kept that positive attitude and kept just the encouragement to Emily. Even if she didn't ever walk, we still would always have kept our attitude toward her, that we're proud of her and that she's a strong child and that we love her. That was the most important thing.
And she knew that from the moment she was born. You had those tapes running. You were visiting her and telling her how strong she was and how much she was loved. And you programmed her right from the start that you really wanted her with you. You weren't going to give, which was a beautiful thing to do. Let's talk for a bit about the power of prayer. Who all did you reach out to for prayer? And I remember your mother being a big part of the prayer thing as well.
Oh, yes. My mother was very, very close to God, and she's on the other side now praying for everything for us right now anyway, and in addition to my sister and my aunts and cousins and my father. And my mom was just always very religious, and she believed that God would take care of Emily. And I had a very religious cousin who lived down in Florida, and she had her church all praying for Emily, and we had cousins across the pond, so to speak, praying for her. It was just the power of prayer is amazing. It's like a strength that just is conveyed. And just, it can do such miraculous things. I just believe that.
And they were praying for you as well, right? It wasn't just for praying for Emily, they were praying for your whole family.
Absolutely. They knew we were going through a lot. They knew it was difficult. And, yeah, they were just really special people out there that helped us get through it all.
You had a lot of them. A lot of people fell in love with your story because it was such a spectacular victory for you. And I remember people being just in awe that you were able to pull this off. Part of why I could do what I did with my dog back in 2013 was remembering to some extent, because at that point my memory wasn't too good yet, but I remembered how you pulled off your memory, how you pulled off your miracle, rather. And it helped to influence me to pull off my own miracle. So I'm asking people who are listening to this right now to just put this in the back of your mind if you don't necessarily need to know this right now. You're going to meet somebody at some point in your life who's going to need a miracle. It may be you. It may be family. It may be friends. And as you listen to this, just kind of file it away in your little index card mind, and you'll know when the time comes to bring this memory forward and tell them, I heard this radio show. Don't even remember the name of the show necessarily, but there was this woman talking about how the power of prayer and the power of love helped her have a healthy baby who's now 26 years old. So that's what I'd like you to do as you're listening to this. And Fran, before we're going to bring Emily on in just a second, but I want to ask you, what would you add to that for people who are going through some sort of a transition and they need to know that it's not necessarily going to work out as bad as everybody says it's going to work out? What advice would you give?
Just to keep encouraging your child or whoever is in need of this, of a miracle, to hang in there. You know, it really makes a big difference in the outcome. We have a friend right now who's very sick, and I'm very worried about him, and I've been praying like crazy for him and telling other people about him and asking my Filipino friend who's very religious, and she's asked her friends, and you know, it's just like the same thing where pass it on to other people to try to help to give you more strength. And just try to be as strong as possible. I know it gets depressing. I know it's very difficult. I was depressed for a lot of the time. But I also know that I never wanted to give up. And I don't think you ever should give up a hope, you know?
What did you do when you had your moments of depression? How did you get through those?
I guess I just talked to Marty, you know, and got lots of hugs. I think that sometimes that's all you need is someone to listen to you and to listen to how you're feeling and to try to help you get through it. And I talked to my mom and, you know, just having friends and family to get you through it is really important.
You got to have a support system, absolutely. And you had a fantastic support system. So what I'm going to do right now is I'd like to bring Emily on to talk about her experience while she was waiting to go home. Emily, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I am so proud of you, sweetheart. You don't know how happy I am that you're here tonight. I mean, I remember how happy we all were when you were born and how happy we were when you came out of the hospital and how happy we were when you started walking. And then I got to see you again a couple of years ago after many years of a break, and I just couldn't get over the miracle that is you. So first of all, thank you for being here. We need to know that things like this are happening. Oh, my God, I'm so delighted that you're here. So I'd like you to tell everybody about the visitor that you had when you were in the hospital.
I unfortunately don't remember as much of it as I'd like to, obviously. It's really just recollections. I think you're talking about God, if I'm not mistaken.
That would be the visitor I had in mind, yes.
Yeah. I know, I guess I said that he had a long white beard or something, long white, what was it?
No.
He had dark hair.
He had dark hair and eyeglasses and a funny voice. That's all I remember.
And he told me everything was going to be okay.
Yeah, and he said everything's going to be okay. This is my mom's recollection. I was probably four at the time, and I don't exactly remember what was said. But it's great that she remembers that, you know, because then I do have that memory, at least from her.
That's phenomenal. So you're lying there in the hospital and you're getting this visit from this guy with long hair and glasses and the weird voice. And at the age that you're at, you know, it's first of all, it's amazing you still have this memory. I'm just in awe that you have this memory. Do you remember anything about how you felt?
I really don't. You know, I wish I did. I wish I could still have, you know, that feeling, that sensation that I would think that one does feel when something like that happens, which is probably just like almost like a peace, like washing over you. Like if you were, you know, so incredibly hot and just, you know, thirsty, and then all of a sudden you're in this amazing land with air conditioning and water, I feel like that's almost what it would be like.
That's a brilliant explanation. Thank you. So at that point, after you're visited by God, you know, you don't remember how you felt, and the fact you remember any of this is a miracle, so thank you for sharing this much. You knew it was going to be okay.
Yeah, absolutely, and, you know, I had my parents and my family, and the fact that they were all there and really rooting for me and cheering me on, you know, making sure that I got everything that I needed and giving me all the prayers and all the hope that they could was just, obviously, it's a huge help, you know, when you have such a big support system. That's really how you can thrive as opposed to survive.
And you definitely had that all the way through. So your mom was talking a bit earlier about when you were 10 months old and they thought you might have cerebral palsy, you might not be able to walk. Do you recall any of that?
I do not. Unfortunately, I don't. But it's been told to me many times that, you know, they said, oh, she's not going to walk. And I don't know if my bio, I know you received it, that, you know, I started ballet dancing when I was 2 years old. So, you know, I did, at least I was definitely walking. I was not only walking, I was dancing. So I think that was a huge accomplishment. And that really proved a lot of people wrong.
You sure did, and you still are. It's really beautiful watching how you developed into this very poised and very intelligent and very verbally. You just know how to express yourself so beautifully. And I remember the first time I saw you, I think it was in 2012, we all had lunch together, and I just kept staring at you because it's just a miracle that you could come through everything and be this beautiful, poised woman, able to speak very intelligently about all these things that you'd been through and knowing that you were here for a purpose. And your mother and your dad and the whole community prayed for you, and that was great. And you also had the tenacity to want to be here.
Right. Yeah, definitely. It was definitely like a fight or flight kind of situation, I would say. There's really, you know, only one choice, and when you pick fight, you're fighting all the way.
And you did a great job of that. So why do you think that your life was saved? What is your purpose? Have you found a purpose yet for your life?
Right now at the moment, it's really just, I try to, you know, do something, at least one nice thing a day for strangers, or, you know, make someone's day by making them feel better, whether it's on social media, whether it's when I'm at work, whether it's I'm out shopping, or, you know, something even at home with my parents, or even my dog. You know, he's important too, just because he can't talk doesn't mean I can't do nice things for him. It's definitely just to pretty much like to make people happy, and to find people, who have like the same kind of thought process as I do. Like my best friend Julia, we're always complimenting each other, and we actually got into a fight this morning about who's nicer. So That is the only fight we've ever gotten in.
Who won?
We both won, apparently.
Good. That's a good fight. That's a good resolution.
Exactly.
So here you are. You've come to this very interesting start to being here in physical form. And you fought your way out of the hospital, and you fought your way through the problems they thought you might have with movement. You learned how to dance. How was school for you? Was school difficult for you, or were you able to master that also?
Oh, it was definitely tough. It's still a tough thing for me. I definitely have I don't know if it's so much a unique style of learning. I'm the person that I only really want to learn about things I'm actually interested in. Like, if I like history, but I only like history of, like, fashion and maybe, like, the royals, but anything else I just can't seem to maintain. School was tough. You know, I had ADD, so that was a little difficult, but, you know, it definitely helped with having teacher's aides and taking medication to help me focus more and, you know, having smaller classes. And only in certain areas did I really thrive, and that was math and foreign languages, and that was pretty much it.
Well, I wish I could trade out that thing with math. That's never been my friend, so we need to talk one of these days. Maybe you can give me that math gene of yours.
I'm only good at algebra. That's about it, is algebra and not geometry.
Can I tell you, I was talking to one of my neighbors today, and I think he's I want to say he's like 10 or 12 years old, I forget, and he was telling me that he's great at algebra. So this is twice today I'm meeting people who are wonderful at algebra. So congratulations. I need to look at this.
Thank you.
Hey, so Fran, here you are. You got this amazing daughter. She's going through life beautifully. She's dancing. She's doing all right. She's having her challenges in school. She's going through. What have you learned from this experience of giving birth to her and raising this amazing daughter?
I have learned that to love her unconditionally, to always make her feel that she's special, that no matter whether she's a doctor or she works in a store, she's still just the most wonderful person. And I just love her, and I feel so positive about her, and I am in awe of her talents. Like, she has an amazing talent for fashion. And
even if I don't drive.
She's still not driving, though. But she is. But I found that just by sending positive messages to her, I think that we've enabled her to be herself. We don't care whether, she's a professional or whatever. I want her to be happy. And I think that the way she is with other people is, I guess, the way we always were with her. Helpful, she's loving, she's giving. She has this real capacity for giving of her time or a sympathetic ear or giving gifts to people when they don't expect it. And just being a really kind and loving person. And I think that it really does matter how you look at your children. Don't ever call them brats. We never did that. We always told our children they were the best and, you know, that they were really good, no matter how difficult that got. So, yeah.
One of the things that Emily does, and I love how she writes. I follow her on Facebook. I follow Fran on Facebook as well. And I love Emily's transparency about her life. She tells it like it is. She talks about what it's like to be her. She talks about her challenges. She talks about her victories. And that's something that's really beautiful, because that's how you form real relationships in life, by being honest about who you are and what you're going through. One of the things I really admire about you is how you've handled your relationship with food. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it pretty much started when I was 10 years old. I went through puberty very early, and I started gaining weight,
And at that point, you know, it was pretty much downhill from there in that I lost all my friends. And as sure as everyone knows, kids are cruel. But pretty much it's with everyone, and I'm not exaggerating, everyone just dropped me because they were like, oh, she's fat. We're not going to be friends with her, which is definitely horrendous. But at 16, I had developed anorexia. And, you know, unfortunately, that was something that is genetic in my family. But, you know, for 3 years, I think, of my life, I suffered from that. And that was really difficult, to be honest. Thankfully, I got help. I had a wonderful therapist that I still keep in touch with every once in a while. She's fantastic. So, you know, just going to treatment definitely helped. And, you know, now it's just, you know, not limiting myself. Thankfully, but still, like, not being afraid to try new things, especially when it comes to food. And I've definitely learned a lot. You know, my father and my sister are both vegetarians. My best friend has celiac disease, so she's gluten-free, so I've learned a lot about food and everything from her as well. So it's nice to be able to go on little adventures in that aspect. But, yeah, I mean, it's the fact that I've been in recovery successfully for 6 years is, it's pretty amazing. I still, not to say I don't struggle, I still struggle every single day, but you know what? It's once again, it's another fight or flight. It's either you keep going or you give in.
So that's what you would tell somebody. If there's somebody listening to this and they have a child who's working with their relationship with food, or they know somebody, what advice would you give them?
You know, I definitely say try to have them talk to either someone they feel very comfortable with or go to a professional, which is definitely, you know, a better route. You know, it's really all about figuring out the reasoning behind it. It's never just about the food. There's always an emotional connection. There's something always in the back of your mind that makes you feel a certain way about a lot of things. Food, you know, drugs, alcohol, shopping. You know, there's always something. There's some sort of emotional connection or to any addiction that, you know, it needs to be discussed. It needs to be thoroughly, you know, just kind of gone over and over again until you really figure out, why am I doing this? How can I either stop or how can I make myself feel better about the reasons why I'm doing this?
Okay.
So it's definitely...
That's definitely what I'm sorry, dear.
No, it's definitely just... It really is definitely about finding yourself. That's what it is. It's really finding yourself, but with the help of others. If you don't take help, then you might not get anywhere, you know, whether it's from prayer, whether it's from a doctor, you know, however you feel most comfortable getting that, I like to call it a second opinion, you know, other than yourself. You have to almost see yourself from an outsider's perspective. That's something that's really difficult for someone in an eating disorder. Like, they wouldn't want their parents or their best friends to go through that, but they don't care about themselves. So you have to think of yourself as your own best friend. How would you treat that? You know, that's really something that I think everyone should try to embrace in their everyday life.
How are you with your self-talk? I know many people, like, you know, the people I work with, the people I know, somehow the people fall into a pattern, and sometimes it's because that's what they heard when they were growing up, or they've heard it on television, but they don't say nice things to themselves. They'll say nice things to other people, but not to themselves. How do you address that issue?
It's taken a really long time for me to feel okay with myself. And, you know, I really look up to, like, my best friend. She's so, like, she loves herself. She's, like, perfectly, you know, fine. She loves the way that she is. She doesn't care about her looks in a way that, you know, it's not, she's not a negative against herself, which I think is really a fantastic thing. And I looked up to her so much in that. She has so much confidence. in herself that it's almost like carefree, and I'm like, oh God, I wish I was like that. But it's definitely something that you have to work on every single day. You know, she's a couple years older than I am, so she does have a little more life experience. So I like to think that the things that she's been through have helped her get to that point. So it really is about not holding yourself back, and really just making sure that you kind of learn how to talk to yourself. Like, even if you talk to yourself in a mirror, or you write something down and then you read it to yourself, you write down all the bad things you say to yourself, and then you read them out loud. You go, if someone said that to me, I'd punch them in the face. Not literally, of course, but, you know, that wouldn't be very nice. So why say it to yourself if you wouldn't let someone else say it to you?
That's it. And how many of us just unconsciously fall into that pattern of saying not nice things to ourselves? But Fran, when you were watching Emily go through this struggle for the years that she was struggling with this, and you're her mother, you love her, you knew what she went through to give birth to her and what she went through in her early years, how did you handle yourself through this?
Good question.
Yeah.
Okay.
She was at a loss as to how to deal with it. And I think that was obviously because it was something that she had gone through herself, but it was something that thankfully she's growing out of. It was tougher for her, for sure, just because it with an eating disorder, it's really, you can't control that person because they have some monster inside of them that's controlling everything they do anyway. So whatever you say to them is kind of just bounced right back at you. So I think that was difficult for her because she couldn't really express herself the way that she wanted to with me.
So basically, I had to try to leave it up to the professionals. Put her in a program to try to help her get through it and to try to help her fight it. It's difficult because she needed a lot of therapy to accept herself and to not want to be somebody who she wasn't, which is what I think I was like when I was in my eating disorder. I was a little older than she was, but I think that it was a way of controlling something in my life because I felt that I couldn't control anything else in my life. I want to say one thing when a parent has a child who's going through anything, who is either handicapped mentally or physically or has an addiction, that child deserves to be helped, to be helped no matter what. Don't think about how people label. Don't even consider it. Just consider the health of your child. Just consider their happiness. Don't make it so important for you to be looked at as the perfect parent with the perfect child. Nobody really is. Behind closed doors, we really don't know what people's lives are like. But I think that no matter what it takes, you have to give them a chance to grow and to be helped when they need help.
You know, I love that you're speaking from your heart. This is fabulous advice. You're not sugarcoating anything. You're not making anything different than it is. You're speaking from your heart to the hearts of all of our listeners, and I thank you for doing that.
My pleasure.
Yeah, both of you. I want to talk for a little bit about your family. You have a very beautiful family relationship. You have a wonderful husband, and you've got three children, and you guys are tight. Now,
yes.
American families, anybody around the world, families are going to have their times. They get close, they get far away, whatever it is. As long as I've known you, you guys have been tight. How did you manage to pull that one off?
Oh, well, maybe Marty and I don't know how to fight. Because we never fight one another. and our children are always saying, I don't understand all these families where the parents are not talking to each other or they're yelling at each other. And our family is like, it's sort of like weird, you know, that we are close and we don't really argue with one another, and we are always supportive of one another and understanding of one another as much as we can be, even though, you know, there have been, like, you know, times when I didn't understand my children and vice versa. But Marty and I have always had sort of a united front, and we just always just showed them how much we love them and what we think of them, which is that they're the most fantastic kids we could ever have. And Marty's the most fantastic husband I could have, too. But yeah, there's a lot of love here. I can tell you that much. There's a lot of love, and there's just empathy. When things are wrong, we talk about it and we try to get through it together. We find strength in the closeness of our family.
Do you feel that the challenges that you've been through have brought you closer together?
Absolutely. I know that in some cases it's the opposite. There are people who are forced to look at things as a couple and don't agree, and that they blame one another for things. They become distant with one another. But I think that every time we've faced a crisis, we've become even closer to one another. And I appreciate that so much. And I think that part of it is our personalities, just the way that we are. You know, just we are naturally loving. You know, we're just a naturally loving couple who just always feel that we get strength from one another. Rather than pushing each other away, we embrace one another. And it's the same with our children. We embrace them, and when we are having problems with anything, they're there for us. They are very, very generous children with their time, their love. They're amazing.
You know, I can remember when Dave was young, your oldest, when Dave was very young, and you would bring him with you to calligraphy workshops, and you would bring him with you to meetings and things like that. From the very beginning, that boy knew he was important to you. And it was beautiful watching this. Nobody else was doing that. And watching you do that with him, you set the stage for him to have a very, very happy life. And now he's married, and he's got a wonderful marriage, too. So look what you created. It's the next generation's following in your footsteps.
I know. It's just it just makes me feel really good to know that he's a happy adult. Because he had a rough time in his teenage years as well. He had severe migraine headaches. He was picked on for being too intelligent, which is, you know, kids can think of anything to pick on you for. And so he had a hard time socializing with kids his own age. He did better with adults, and one of his therapists told me at one time that he will make a great adult. We just need to get him through his teenage years. And he was right, because he is a great adult. He's amazing. And his wife, Holly, she's so amazing. I love her so much. She's just like she's been part of our family forever, it seems. And she's a wonderful, loving, giving person, just like I would want Dave to have. Know what I would want for him. And he's a yes, dear, which is great, at least in my opinion.
You've done a magnificent job. Before we end, we have a few minutes to go before we end, but I want to share with the audience that I have a very dear friend who lives in London, Ontario, Canada. She's a very close friend of mine. And she does energy work, and she had a client who was also in a high-risk pregnancy several years ago. and the client was getting feedback from the doctors that probably not going to work out, don't get too attached. It's pretty much the same stuff you were going through many, many years ago. And my friend didn't really know what to tell her. She knew that Sarah had great spirits, and she really wanted to help her. And I was able to share your story with Fran, with my friend Susan. And what happened was, the more I would tell Susan about what happened with you, she would tell this to Sarah. And it gave Sarah the courage to keep on, even though she wasn't hearing good things from the doctors necessarily. And Sarah gave birth to her son. She almost died in childbirth. She had a very difficult time of it. But I got to speak with Sarah directly on the phone in March of this year. She called me to thank me. She wanted to wait until she was strong enough to have this conversation because she knew she was going to cry. And because of all you shared with me so many years ago, I was able to share this with somebody in a different country who was going through a similar challenge. So thank you so much for helping her and her family and most of all her son, Sage.
Yes, I wish Sarah and her child the very best. And I just want her to know that she should just let her son be who he is and just help him when she can and get him, just make sure that she gets him help if there's anything wrong, and don't worry about people labeling him, because in the end, it doesn't really matter. When they're grown, no one knows about the fact that you were in a handicapped program when you were a little child unless you tell them. You know, it's just so important for her to keep positive and just give as much love to her baby as she can.
And I know she's listening to this, either live or on the archives. So, Sarah, that was for you, dear. And we're so happy you're part of this with us, even though you're not speaking with us on the phone. Emily, do you have any closing remarks for the audience after everything we've talked about tonight? What would you like to leave people with?
Never underestimate the power of a hug.
Yeah. For sure. And I would say for you, never underestimate the power of a hug from your dog. Would you go along with that?
Oh, absolutely I would. I would go along with that any day of the week.
Had a feeling you would. And Fran, what about you? Any closing remarks?
Well, I'd say never underestimate your own power, the power of your mind, of the positivity that you can have, and the strength that you really have inside you, no matter what you need to go through. It's amazing what we can dredge up when we need to. And
amen.
Yeah.
Amen, sister. Well, thank you both so much for being with us tonight on Catalytic. Franz Teeterer and her beautiful daughter, Emily. You've inspired many people tonight, and we're very, very grateful that you chose to be here with us.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Next time, join us for Dr. Michael Irving from Toronto, Canada, talking about how living from the heart creates a healthy heart. My name is Cheryl Hirsch-Kramer, and what do you do when life happens? You know what to do now. You get catalytic. Many blessings.